morning, everyone. Glad that you're here. All of our visitors, you're especially welcome. You're welcome back at any time, and we're glad that you've chosen to worship with us this morning. If you want to open up your Bibles to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 15, that's where we're going to be spending our time reading and learning this morning. Matthew, chapter 15. We've been going through the Gospel of Matthew and reading the story of Jesus, how he was born, how he's gone through his ministry in this world, teaching about what God truly expects from his people, and leading them towards what will be his ultimate sacrifice on behalf of all people. But as we're reading through this, we're not quite there yet. We often focus, as well we should, on the cross and the sacrifice, as we did just a few moments ago. But Jesus did much in his life, and he taught much in his life, and that's what we are looking to and are learning from this morning. Here in his ministry, as he's going about teaching and performing miracles, we come today to some conflict that he has with religious people, which is something that we should always pay particular attention to. Sometimes when we read passages like this that has Jesus meeting with the religious leaders of his time, it's easy to leave it in its time and its culture and to say, well, of course they were wrong and of course they were backwards. But it's always worth paying close attention to when we think about the big picture of what's happening. That when the religious conservative people of his time met with Jesus, they did not always see eye to eye. And so as people who are trying to follow Christ, who are trying to be conservative about what we believe especially, we need to listen carefully to what Jesus has to say to these type of people and not write it off as always advice for other people and never for ourselves. The question that begins our reading today is an important one. Do you have to wash your hands? This is how our reading starts today. And I'm being serious. This is not a clever hook to get you interested or anything. The first couple verses, they'll say, why don't your disciples wash their hands before they eat? Let's read this. This is Matthew chapter 15 and the first couple verses. Then the Pharisees and the scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem, and they said, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat. This was a big deal for them. And in some ways, it may be a big deal for us, in some ways not. You know, that's always a big question. Do you have to wash your hands? For us, in our world, in our culture, we don't have a law that codifies anything like that. And personal judgment differs from person to person. And I won't ask you to raise your hands in any of these, but we ask questions in different situations. Do you have to wash your hands before you eat? And say, well, maybe it depends on what you've been doing that day. You know, do you wash your hands when you get home from church, when you've shaken, 80 people's hands? Some people, that's a big deal. Some people, they don't think about it at all. Maybe it depends on what time of year it is. Is it flu season? Is it cold season? If not, I could probably just go straight to lunch. Do you have to wash your hands if you're working outside, maybe in the shop or something, and you've got grease or oil all over your hands? Do you have to wash them? Maybe it depends on where you're at. You know, if you're still going to be working outside, you can probably keep them dirty. But maybe you come inside and your wife has just cleaned and the house is spick and span, you probably better wash those hands pretty quickly before you get it on all the pillows or anything like that. If you're cooking, what ingredients do you have to touch that demands a washed hand and what not? If you're making a sandwich, probably don't need to wash your hands. If you're chopping up onions, might be a good idea. There's all these situations, and every single one has a different answer. It's like, do you have to? Do you have to? And maybe that's the way we feel about it. Do I have to? You know, I don't really feel like I need to, but should I? That's maybe where we're from. And for us in our world, in our culture, this is almost entirely a health question. Maybe especially in the world events over the last 5 years or so. When we talk about washing our hands, we're worried about health and safety. When we buy soap, it says things about how many bacteria it kills. I've yet to find any that kills 100% but you get pretty close, you know, 99.9 or something. We wash our hands so that we can kill germs and be healthy. It's a health issue. But for the people of Jesus' day, it was much more a religious issue. Cleanliness was next to godliness in the time and the culture that Jesus lived in. This was not just a phrase, it was part of God's law that he gave to people. And for us, a health issue was for them a religious issue. And that's why the Pharisees and the religious leaders, they come to Jesus and they're concerned and probably have something of an axe to grind with Jesus. This may not be an entirely sincere question. When they say, why don't your disciples wash their hands? They're breaking the tradition of the elders. In the old law, cleanliness was a very, very important thing. It was not merely a health concern. It was part of being in a relationship with God. Being a part of his people that were holy, being able to worship, had a lot to do with whether you were clean or unclean by what the law had marked out as either one. And so it is here in Matthew 15. Jerusalem sends up an investigation or something like that to see who this preacher is, who everyone's talking about, and to wonder, why isn't he keeping to the conservative standards that us teachers teach? We've talked before about how the people of Jesus' day, this group, the Pharisees especially, were very careful about following God's law to a T and making sure they didn't even get close to breaking God's law. So they added all sorts of extra rules to God's word to make sure he didn't even come close to breaking it. Heaping up, as they say, the tradition of the elders. Maybe God's word doesn't say you have to wash your hands before every meal, but all the teachers say you have to, just to be sure, just to be safe. And so this was their question. And Jesus' answer here is in verse 3. He answered them and said, why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your traditions? For God commanded, honor your father and your mother, and whoever reviles your father and your mother must surely die. But you say, if anyone tells his father or his mother, what you would have gained from me is devoted to God, he need not honor his father. And so for the sake of your tradition, you have made void the word of God. You hypocrites! Well did Isaiah prophesy of you when he said, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. They're worried about this hand washing, which for us is not a religious issue. I don't think anybody this morning who's here woke up and said, well, everybody wash their hands or you're not allowed to go to worship. You're not allowed to sing if you haven't washed your hands yet. If you did, we should probably talk afterwards, sort some things out. You might have a few things backwards in what you're talking about at home. But for God's people in the first century and for centuries before that, the law of Moses talks all about how being clean will regulate whether or not you get to be a part of God's people, whether or not you get to worship with God's people. The law of Moses is chock full of lists of things that are clean and unclean, how it is that you're made clean. And the point is that God is holy. He is special. He is exalted above everything else. He is perfect. And so for you to walk in with dirty hands or having touched things that are gross and unclean and dying, you can't come and come to God like that. You've got to clean yourself up. And so there's all sorts of laws about how to do this. And being clean is what allows you to worship and to participate in God's people or not. If you've got a sickness that is contagious, that's unclean, you don't get to live with your family anymore. You have to go into what was maybe some of the first ever quarantines. Talks about it in the old law. If you've touched something that's unclean, you don't get to go sacrifice at the temple. You don't get to go sing praises. You have to wait until you're cleaned up. And that might take sacrifice. That might take weeks of waiting. But being clean was the trick. Because God is perfect. He is righteous and clean, and you can't come to him if you're not. The cleanliness laws are also what marks out Israel as separate from everybody else. No, they're God's chosen people. No one else on earth is quite like the Israelites in the Old Testament. God picked them out special. And so as such, this is what makes them different. And you can imagine looking at it from an outsider perspective as someone who's a law-abiding Jewish person. It makes doing anything with them very difficult because they have all these stipulations. And this is what makes them separate, not just in what they think, what they believe, but what they do. If you are living in an ancient city, like probably not Jerusalem, that's a whole lot of Jewish people in one place, but anywhere else in the ancient world, you live in Corinth or Ephesus or something, and here's all your people who live in your community, and you got a bunch of Gentile people, and they spend all day touching unclean animals and eating unclean animals and sinning in all sorts of ways against the law. It's like, if I want to worship, I can't even be close to these people because I'll catch their uncleanness. It means you don't eat with Gentiles. You don't spend time with them. You're completely separate as God's people. And it was something that they wore as a badge of honor. This wasn't difficult for them. They said, look how special we are. God may look down on everyone else, but we are the ones God's chosen, and we're special because of what he's done for us. And Jesus, it seems, is going against these sorts of things with what he's doing with his disciples. And something that we should remember here is that as much as Jesus is going to criticize their understanding of being clean before God, this is something that God ordained. And when we talk about the law of Moses and how we don't have to keep it anymore, and we can look at some parts of it and say, you know, that's kind of ridiculous or silly. Can you imagine not being able to eat pork or catfish or wear two different kinds of fabric or anything like that? But we must remember that although their added traditions were something that was trouble, God is the one who is the author of the law of Moses. He is the one who made the clean and unclean laws. And it was not mere preference. You know, the law, though men's traditions took it too far, God wrote the law, and he was serious about it. In Leviticus chapter 10, there's two priests, sons of Aaron, the very first priest. And they come to worship God, and they make a sacrifice, and in Leviticus chapter 10 at the beginning, there's Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron. They each took censer and put fire in it and laid incense on it, and they offered strange fire, unauthorized, before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. And Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord has said, among those who are near me, I will be sanctified. Before all the people, I will be glorified." Aaron held his peace. We can talk about how strange it is to our culture, but being particular about what God had said was not mere preference. This is life or death. Here are two priests, holy, righteous people. They come to offer something to God, but it's not what he told them to do. And they lost their lives because of it. We talk about being clean or unclean, this is serious business to God's people. This is not a small thing to them. And it seems that Jesus and his disciples are just trampling all over it. But what Jesus gets onto them for is their inconsistency. Jesus shows the Pharisees hypocrisy, looking for legal loopholes. You know, you can go around bashing everyone for not washing their hands, but here they're breaking some of the most fundamental laws about honoring your father and your mother by saying, well, you know, I've dedicated this money to God and I can't help you out. You can imagine this. It's extreme. It's like a political cartoon or like a caricature where someone is religiously, literally religiously washing their hands, trying to be clean before God, trying to be pleasing God that way. And then their parents come to them and they don't have much, and they need money to put food on the table. And they say, hey, you know, I'm sorry, I would help you, but I was planning on giving this money to God on Saturday or on Sunday for worship. So, you know, tough luck. Sorry, Mom and Dad, can't help you. It's like, that's not pleasing to God. You can be as ritually clean as you want, but you're not actually doing what God wants you to do, honoring your father and your mother. So Jesus says, you're not being consistent in what you're doing. You're teaching, as it says, the doctrines of men as if they were the commandments of God. And that's what we try to avoid so much here in our church. If God says to do it, we do it. If God says don't do it, we don't do it. We try as much as we can to not bind anything that's someone's idea, some person's idea. We stand by what God says, not other things. And what Jesus is going to go on to teach them is that being clean before God, being approved by God, has so much to do with what is on the inside rather than what's on the outside. Look here in verse 10. Jesus called the people to him and said, "Hear and understand. It is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth. This is what defiles a person." The disciples came to him and said, "Do you know that the Pharisees were scandalized when they heard this saying?" He said, "Every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be rooted up. Leave them alone. They are blind guides, and if the blind lead the blind, they both fall into a pit." Peter said, "Explain this parable to us." He said, "Are you also still without understanding? Don't you see that whatever goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is expelled? But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this defiles a person. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, and slander. These are what defile a person. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile anyone." Jesus clarifies the issue for these people. It is not these external things that make us disapproved by God because it's clean or unclean. He says, no, what really counts before God is what is on the inside. And that's not so easily fixed. You know, if you're unclean because your hands are unwashed, or because you've touched some unclean thing, there's a way to resolve that that doesn't take a whole lot of work on your part. You don't have to become a new person. But if what is unclean is on the inside, it's part of your character, it's part of who you are, that takes a whole lot more work, a whole lot more effort to change that, to make yourself approved by God. It's the same thing that Jesus has been teaching his entire ministry. You know, he says on the Sermon on the Mount, you say, or you've heard it said, you shall not murder. Jesus says, don't even be angry. You know, it's not even these external actions that are just the problem. It's where it starts. And here, the teaching is not so much that if you have the right intentions, you know, everything's fine, if your heart's in the right place. It's from your heart that actions follow. And if you've got bad on the inside, it's going to come out on the outside. And in the same way, if you've got good on the inside, it will be obvious in the things that you're doing. Jesus clears it out, and it's something that we have to pay careful attention to. Being clean on the inside, not just on the outside. We can't look around at ourselves and be proud of ourselves and be thankful, because you can look at a big list of sins and say, I haven't done those things. I haven't done these external things, and man, that makes me a good person. When on the inside, your heart is not right. If you are proud, if you are selfish, if you are vain, if you are uncompassionate, these things are what God cares about, and he sees what's on the inside, even if other people don't. So he says, it doesn't matter if you wash your hands. What matters is what is on the inside, and that will be obvious. It certainly is to God. And so this is where it starts. He talks about clearing up this issue of cleanliness. And it's an impure heart that causes impure actions. What God cares about is the inner life that comes out in action, not the small thing about washing your hands. What follows as Jesus is done with this teaching is Jesus in action. And he's going to practice what he has just preached about what God approves of, what is clean and what's unclean, in a pretty shocking healing account in the next verses. Let's read together at verse 21. This is Matthew 15 and verse 21. Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. This is outside of the land of Israel. This is where non-Israelites live. This is the Jewish or the Gentile part of the world. And as such, he's in, as we've been reading, unclean territory. Verse 22. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." But Jesus did not answer her a word. His disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she's crying out after us." And he answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered, it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. She said, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. And Jesus answered her, O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire. And her daughter was healed instantly. Jesus is teaching about purity and what is actually approved of God in his sight, what God actually cares about, is shown in practice by this persistent, faithful Gentile woman. This is an account in the Gospels that is troubling to a lot of people. It's hard to understand because so many times as we read the Gospels, we see Jesus' compassion, wearing it on his sleeve. How many times, it's been two or three times already in the Gospel of Matthew, that Jesus will look out at the crowd and he'll say that he's compassionate towards them. His heart goes out to the people. There's not a single person so far in the entire gospel who has come to Jesus asking for help, that someone be healed, and he has neglected them. That hasn't happened once, but then all of a sudden, he's in this Gentile area, and this Gentile woman comes to him, says, please help my daughter. And apparently Jesus has zero interest to do so. We say, what in the world's going on? That's not the Jesus that I know. You know, it's a strange story to wrap our heads around. But I think what's clear to us is that Jesus is drawing something out of this woman. He's showing her faithfulness by some resistance. It's been clear so far in the gospel that Jesus is ready and willing to bless everybody. It's been said earlier in the chapter, or in the book, about how in his name all the Gentiles will hope. And he's already helped a Gentile centurion, a Roman military officer at that. It's not that Jesus has any prejudice, but in a way it's a way of showing something or drawing something out of someone. It's like when a teacher asks questions of her students in order to get them to see a point at the end. Or, this is not really a good phrase to use in this context, but it's as if Jesus is playing devil's advocate. He agrees with this woman, and he's going to bless her. But it's because of his resistance that she makes these great statements of faith. You know, it's like whenever Adam and Eve are hiding in the garden, God says, where are you? What have you done? God knows the answer, but he's giving them a chance to explain themselves. And it's a similar thing here. In some ways, Jesus is acting out the prejudice of God's people at the time. You know, I'm not going to help anyone who's not of God's chosen people. I'm not going to have any compassion on them. But what Jesus shows is that while this woman may not be clean by God's standards in the old covenant, or especially by the traditions of men, her heart is exactly in the right place. She has complete confidence in Jesus, and she's not going to give up asking for a blessing until it happens. It's like this incredible, persistent, steadfast faith in this woman. She's willing to take any kind of, you know, tough language, being called a dog, she's like, whatever, as long as you'll bless me, Jesus. You know, if we had this kind of persistence in our prayers and this kind of humility as we come to Jesus, we would all be better off. And so Jesus says in verse 28, great is your faith. May it be done for you. Jesus is putting on display what he's just taught, that what matters to God is not so much are you ritually clean or unclean. Have you touched something gross or not? Have you washed your hands or not? What matters to God is, where is your heart? Is it in the right place? And does that lead you to a godly life or not? Because here's the difference. You look at the external things and you make a judgment, but God sees the heart. Here earlier we had these scribes and these Pharisees coming. These are the religious leaders, the religious elite. You know, we might say, putting it in our context, we've got these elders of churches. We've got these, you know, old, wizened people who have been faithful to God for so long, and they come to Jesus, but they are not coming to seek him, and they're not coming with any good intentions in their heart. The Pharisees come to judge him and to say, Jesus, why aren't you doing what we want you to do? And here's this woman who is not a Jewish person. She's not clean by those standards, But her heart is seeking after Jesus and will not give up until she has him. So on the outside, we might make a judgment about that. But on the inside, God knows who these people truly are. He says, one of these is approved and one is not. This is a woman who's a Gentile, but she finds favor with Jesus because she has faith in him, a faith that will not give up. This is what matters to her, and it needs to be what matters to us. You know, do we have the same kind of drive and hunger for righteousness and for God's blessing as we do for looking right, for doing the right things, going through the right motions? It does not matter if we keep all the rules correctly, if we don't do it out of love for Jesus, if we do it out of obligation or expectation, or so that people will look at us well. No, that's not what matters to God. And it won't be what counts in the end. What follows as Jesus helps this woman is what we've seen before in the gospel. All sorts of people bring all of their sick and their injured, they're demon-possessed, and Jesus heals them all. Verse 32 and following, there's a huge crowd, 4,000 plus people. And Jesus doesn't want to send them away hungry, and so he says, let's feed the people. And still the disciples don't quite understand how this could happen, although they've seen it before. But Jesus miraculously multiplies this food, feeds everyone. The point is, when you're with Jesus, you're completely satisfied. You're not wanting for anything. Jesus takes care of all of his people's needs. And it brings us to where this reading for today ends. And the final warning for us as we read it today as disciples. Read with me together. This is Matthew chapter 16 at the beginning of the chapter. It says, and the Pharisees and the Sadducees came to test him. And they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. And he answered them, when it's evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. In the morning, you say, it will be stormy today, because the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. And he left them and departed. When the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. And Jesus said to them, watch and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And they began discussing it among themselves, saying, we didn't bring any bread. But Jesus, aware of this, said, oh, you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive? Don't you remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? How is it that you fail to understand that I don't speak to you about bread? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It seems this whole chapter, people have been so focused on what is external and physical and something they can see and touch, and it's not at all what God is concerned with. Whether it's washing your hands or bread to eat, these are not the things that God is worried about. He's worried about what's on the inside. This chapter begins with the Pharisees and the Sadducees come to test him, to see if they can trap him in something or to see what he's really about. And so they ask for a sign from heaven. The question I would ask is, how much more do they want? How much more evidence do you need that Jesus is who he says he is, that he is the Son of God, that he is from heaven? I mean, how many scores of people has Jesus healed in his time already? How many miracles has he done? He's raised the dead. He's made the blind see and the lame walk. He's cast out demons. And then you come to Jesus and you say, prove it to me, Jesus. What more proof do you need? And whether it's the people who walked on the earth the same time as him or it's people today, the question is, what more proof do you need? You know, you look at, for us today, 2,000 years of church history, of people changing their lives, being able to do so because of what Christ has done for them. And then you say, well, I'll believe if God shows me a sign, if he can prove it with some miracle. That doesn't come from an honest heart. That comes from demanding that God play your games and jump through your hoops. He says in verse 2 and 3, you guys know how to interpret the signs of the weather, but you can't see what's right in front of you. That God is doing impossible things right under your nose, and you refuse to see it. He says in verse 4, something we've talked about before, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. That just like Jonah was as good as dead, 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, but he was alive again at the end, so Jesus would be dead, 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth, but he would rise up again, alive. The final proof, for anyone who's demanding proof, the final evidence for who Jesus is the resurrection, that he was dead and he's raised again. This is the bedrock of our faith. But as it goes, this passage is a warning from Jesus to look out for the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It's clarified at the end as the teaching. What is their teaching that's so dangerous, that permeates everything and grows and fills everything else up like leaven does? The great error, as you might have seen on the screen, is hypocrisy. It's thinking that you're doing the right thing because of what it looks like on the outside, but the inside is not right before God. The great error is thinking that because you're checking the list of rules and it looks good on the outside, that because other people approve, God must approve. But that's not the case. They are proud and arrogant, and it comes from an attitude that treats their relationship like God like a vending machine. If I press all the right buttons, if I do the right steps, I'll get my reward in the end. Or it's some kind of cold transaction. If I keep all of God's rules, then he has to bless me because I've done everything right. But this is not possible from anyone. And it's not, and as much as you can fool people, you're not going to fool God. It's not what's on the outside that counts in God's eyes. It's what's on the inside that changes your life, but it starts at the inside. This is the equivalent of when we think about the religious leaders or the religious conservative. It's like the equivalent of us as people being so proud of the fact that we're trying to do everything the way the Bible teaches and patting ourselves on the back because we sing and we don't have instruments in our worship, or because we take the Lord's Supper every Sunday and we think that we are approved by God because of these things. But when we go out our lives, our hearts are cruel and uncompassionate. They're not generous. They're not just. We look down on others and we're spiteful of others. But, you know, everything we do in worship is by the book. God says, I don't approve of those things. That is not good to me. Now, do we follow the rules and do so carefully to honor God? Absolutely. The point is not, you know, throw out the rule book and just try and be a good person. That's not the gospel. But if our hearts are wrong, it does not matter the actions we do. It does not matter how closely we can follow rules if it doesn't come out of love and devotion to God. If it comes because we're trying to be proud of ourselves, because we're trying to make ourselves look good to other people, we've fallen into the trap. And God does not approve of those things. That is not clean in his eyes. And so, as this church and as disciples, let us continue to be careful about the way that we live our lives. The Pharisees are not judged because they paid too much attention. God is pleased when we are careful to follow his laws. That's a good thing. But let us also reflect on who we are as people. Are we people who are proud and arrogant? Are we people who are humble and compassionate? Because God sees what's truly there. And we can fool people perhaps our whole lives by the outside looking good. But if the inside is not clean, God will know. And he will not approve. It is as God said when David was chosen to be king. He had all his brothers lined up. And David's the youngest. And he's the smallest. And in fact, he's not even there the first time that the prophet comes. And he's got all his brothers. And they're tall and they're strapping and they're strong men. And the prophet comes and he says, these have got to be somewhere in here. This is the king that God's chosen, you know, someone who looks the part. But God says, none of these people are the man that I've chosen. Because as it says, do not look at his appearance or the height of his stature, because I've rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. I'll ask you this morning, what does God see when he looks at you? What does he see? If it needs to change, if it needs to be right, if it needs to be cleaned up in a way that other people cannot tell by looking at you, he's willing to do so, and he wants to. Heaven's invitation is open. If you need to change your life, you must before it's too late. And we'd love to help you. You can come up to the front while we all stand and we sing our song.